All right. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Vicki Brown, and I serve on the formation team here at Imago Dei. And I just want to say that Charlie made me do this. I've spoken a couple times here. I've shared my story, and I did an interview about Advent Conspiracy over Christmas. And so just to start, I'm going to read a prayer, more for me than for you. So I invite you to pray with me. Christ as a light, illumine and guide me. Christ as a shield, overshadow me. Christ under me, Christ over me, Christ beside me on my left and my right. This day be within and without me, lowly and meek yet all-powerful. Be in the heart of each to whom I speak, in the mouth of each who speaks to me. This day be within and without me, lowly and meek yet all-powerful. Christ as a light, Christ as a shield, Christ beside me on my left and my right. Amen. Just so you know, the reason I agreed to do this was because I love you guys, and I love the church, and you're important to me. So please know that. Even though I'm nervous, what I'm saying to you is because I love you. Step 7 for the 12 steps is that we've humbly asked God to remove our shortcomings. And I'm going to focus on what humbly means, and I'm going to focus on what shortcomings means. But first, what I want to do is share a dream with you that I had. And I get these at really random times in my life, and this is one that I had several years ago. In my dream, I'm standing like on a barren plain, and it's kind of dark, and I'm covered in like a glass case. And this glass case is what I have put out for everybody to see. It's my image management case, so to speak, okay? And it covers me perfectly, it fits me perfectly, but it's still, I'm covered, I'm in a glass case. And someone comes up to the case and they hit it with a hammer and all of the pieces fall off and I'm standing completely exposed on this barren, dark plain. And I hear God's voice and I'm talking with God and I'm asking him, "Dear God, all of the pieces that I've put together so carefully have broken. I don't know which pieces to pick up and put back." And God says to me in our conversation, "What if I tell you to pick none of them up?" That's terrifying, but it's also very beautiful. And I think that it signifies the start of a journey that I've been on for a long time. So I'm going to share with you about that. Last week, Mandy talked about being ready and coming to the place where we can have our shortcomings removed. It wasn't asking for it yet. It was just being ready. And she kind of touched on the idea, if we're ready to have these defects of character removed, are we willing to be re-identified? Our character defects for so long, for a lot of us, have defined who we are. And so are we ready to set those aside and become re-identified with the way that God sees us? And I have to tell you that my issues with being unable to identify who I really am really run deep in me. Who am I? Am I just a mom? I've shared with that at Imago. Am I just a wife? Am I just a church leader? Am I just anything? And I think that that word "just" is really damaging, especially because I don't feel like a lot of times I'm very good at any single one of those roles. That idea of not being good enough runs deep. So how do I fit into the kingdom? Does my personality matter? Am I only a list of my character defects? My personality matter? If I have Christ in me, which I believe, is that really all God, is that all he sees? Does he just see Christ in me? And if that's true, I don't even understand why my personality would matter if God only sees Christ when he looks at me. I do know how to demand spiritual enlightenment from God. And Charlie did a sermon series several years ago about how God is not a vending machine. And I absolutely know how to treat God as a vending machine. But I also know how to grovel melodramatically for forgiveness, of being in that place of just spiraling downward and feeling like I'm worth nothing. And are either one of those positions really me? And I don't know always the answer to that question, especially on my bad days. And I have to say that in the process of re-identifying myself, I had the sense of entitlement. I also realized in that process that my vision of God was incredibly skewed, and partly because, and mostly because, I didn't know how to be my true self before God. That, personally, that idea of not knowing how to be your true self before God or anybody else is why that dream that I had was so terrifying, and I still say beautiful at the same time. I don't know. It's just so foreign to me. I was taught growing up that you just need to know God. If you just know God good enough, you're going to be fine. And what I eventually came to realize is knowing God wasn't enough. I had to know myself too. Charlie's talked about this book before. I'm going to quote from it extensively today. It's David Benner's book, The Gift of Being Yourself. And what he says about identity is this. He says, an identity grounded in God would mean that when we think of who we are, the first thing that would come to mind is our status as someone who is deeply loved by God. And I finally came to a place where I had to ask the question, do I believe this? Is this the first thing that comes to mind when I think about myself standing before God? Do I believe God? Not do I believe in him? The fact that I'm asking that question, I think, says that I do. But do I actually believe what he says to me? The Bible calls God gentle and patient. Do I believe that? Was I willing to accept that he would be gentle and patient with me? Perfect love casts out fear. Do not be afraid. These are said in Scripture over and over. And I just did a quick search, over 70 references to God saying, do not be afraid. But if you're standing there exposed on a barren plain, how can you not be afraid? These scriptures speak, you know, they speak to the dry places of my soul, and I want to believe them. But the big question, the one that God loves me, does God love me? Not in spite of myself, but because I am myself? That's the question that I don't even know how to respond to sometimes, especially when I don't even know who myself, you know, who I am. Benner once again says that when we're in this process of identifying ourselves, it's important for me to remember that I am a human being, not a human doing. My worth lies in who I am, not what I can do or how I am seen by others. This is the truth of my existence. And so those ideas, am I just a wife? Am I just a mom? Am I just a church leader? Those things don't define me because those are things that I do. Step seven, once again, they say this step is a step of humility. We're humbly asking God to remove our shortcomings. And I want to talk about what humility really is because I can live really clearly in the two ends of the continuum there. I can live in grandiosity. And I can think that I am so good, there is nothing that needs to be changed about me. And we all know those people, and we all have those moments in our lives when we know what that is. We are basically too big for our britches, is what my mom would say to me. But the other side of that is the one that I probably identify with the most, is this idea of living in intense shame, that I am worth nothing, and my mistakes are all that I have. Those are all the things that define me. What I want to say about humility is that humility is being your true self. It's being your true size. And figuring out who that is, I think, is the goal of our life and the goal of our relationship with God. We have the responsibility of maintaining this middle ground. And I think that that's where spiritual transformation happens. The steps up to this point have revealed shortcomings. They've helped us know ourselves. And believe me, I feel like I've been in counseling for 3 years basically about this idea, knowing where we get it wrong. I think we all do that really well. And knowing where we get it wrong kind of puts everybody, at least me, puts us in a tailspin of I don't know what to do, and you just kind of stay down low because you're not sure what to do with yourself. But I have to say that being in the body of Christ, figuring out some of these issues, I no longer believe that these things, these shortcomings, are what define me. And I no longer think that that's what God is mainly interested in my life. I don't think that he looks at me and only sees my faults. Now, the enemy, on the other hand, definitely wants me to stay obsessed with my sins. Absolutely. If I stay in a state of obsession or self-loathing about what I've done, I do not move forward at all. And that's exactly what Satan wants. The prayer of penitence is something that we've been saying through Lent, and there's a short version that I say every morning. And the reason that this is so important to me every morning is that basically I am agreeing with what the accuser says. He's not saying anything new to me. He can accuse me all he wants, but I already know that. And he's not saying anything that's new to God. God already knows too. So if I can say it in the morning and I can say, yep, this is true, now let's move on, let's move forward, it's a freeing moment every morning to agree and move on and realize that those things don't define me. And I will say that owning who I am helped me not to drown in my imperfections, because for a long time that's exactly what was happening. Some Christians base their identity on being a sinner. This is another quote from Benner. It's not going to be on the slides. He says, "I think they have it wrong, or only half right. You are not simply a sinner. You are a deeply loved sinner. And there is all the difference in the world between those two." And once I came to that realization, I feel like things started to happen inside of me. I'm a parent, and I want you guys to know that I feel like this is how God sees us. So when I look at my children, I do not see all the mistakes they have made. I do not define them by their mistakes. They are my children. I see the way they smile. I see the joy they take in being with their family. I see the way they are learning to encourage each other as they play and learn and grow in love. And when I do see them struggle, I try to help them deal with it and lay it aside and move forward. And that's not always easy. But I do believe that when God sees me, that's what he sees. He sees the way that I smile. And he sees me struggle, and he tries to help me move on and move forward. So when I come to God and ask him to remove my shortcomings, it's so I can be myself, but it's also so I can be with other people. Nobody wants to be around somebody who is only living in shame. They're just not very fun people to be around. Charlie had mentioned that before, for a different quote. We should make it easy for others to love us. So I'm hoping that by asking God to remove my shortcomings, I can love people and serve people better. I'm hoping that there's healing for my soul, so that I can move forward. And honestly, this is such a healthier way to see how God views my faults. Instead of an angry father, I see a loving daddy who wants the best for his child. He's excited to be with me, to show me the beauty that he created just for me. But ultimately, in this step, we do humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings. And you have to ask yourself, do I believe that God will actually remove my shortcomings? And the answer for me is a resounding yes. I'm still working it out day by day, and I am not perfect at this. It's what the passage in Philippians talked about, that I've not taken hold of this yet, but there is that thing out there that I long for. What I am sure of from experience, even with all this talk of true selves, you know, knowing yourself, is that I really cannot do this removing of my shortcomings. It's not something I can do on my own. I absolutely cannot. What I have found that I can do, if there has to be an action step, is to be available, to be in a place that's open to God and what he wants for me. Benner says this about spiritual transformation. Spiritual transformation does not result from fixing our problems. It results from turning to God in the midst of them and meeting God just as we are, with our case of image management and pieces around us, meeting God on a dark, barren plain and hearing his voice wash over you. The act of spiritual transformation that I long for and I kind of see inside of me sometimes, it happens in fits and starts, is something that I ultimately believe only God can do. Hebrews 12:2 tells us that Jesus is the author and perfecter of our faith. Jesus is. God is the one doing those things in us. It is not something that we do. And I hope that you realize that that is so freeing. It does not abdicate us from responsibility. We still have responsibility to be open, but that Jesus ultimately steps in and is the one who authors our faith. He's the one writing it in your life. He's the perfecter of it. He's the one that's making it good and true and beautiful. And I really, really hope that you realize how freeing that is as you go throughout go from here. Jesus, Rohr quotes Jesus in Matthew, and he says, "Don't dare go after your faults yourselves, or you will go after the wrong one," or more commonly, a clever substitute for the real thing. As Jesus says, if you try to pull out the weeds, you might pull out the wheat along with it. So Jesus has to be the one that does the work of untangling it and figuring it out. And honestly, like I said, I've been in counseling for 3 years for this stuff. I just got to the point, and I still do, where I am tired of trying to do this on my own. We can try harder. We can get more upset with ourselves when we fail. And honestly, that's where I lived for a long time, feeling like I was failing and getting so mad at myself that I couldn't figure this out. And we can ultimately say that it doesn't matter. But there is something inside of us that knows that this does matter. This work of spiritual transformation does matter because we long for something more. We long for, in the Lord's Prayer, on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we want inside of us. So as I'm sure you've realized, this step puts it all out there for God. If you're actually humbly asking God to remove your shortcomings, it puts you in a state of vulnerability before God. This is our part, our responsibility, as I mentioned before. Our part is to be available and vulnerable before God. But let's be honest, prayer is where we tap into every single practical insecurity that we have about God. We tap into it and it meets us there. And that's where the question I asked earlier, do I believe God, is put to the test. Once again, not do I believe in God. The fact that you're praying to him kind of says that you do. But do you believe that God will do what he says? So let me share some of the things that people at Imago say about prayer. And the reason I want to share this with you is because I want everybody to realize that people across the church are saying the same thing that maybe you've said to yourself. Is prayer for myself selfish? I feel jaded in prayer. Is it okay to read prayers? How do you keep going in prayer when you don't hear anything? Are short prayers good enough? My prayer life is better when I'm in desperation. Can I call it a prayer if it doesn't start with dear God or if it isn't out loud? I'm scared to pray because, and there's a list there, I fear I'll be asked to do too much. I don't want to be disappointed. I want to protect God's image. I'm afraid people will judge me for how I pray, and I'm scared it doesn't really matter. Am I praying for the right thing? Or I don't want to pray because I want to be in control. People across the church are saying all the same things about prayer. I've sat in two groups so far, even just this year, and everybody is saying these things. It's really vulnerable, right? So why pray? Why should you ask God to remove your shortcomings? Doesn't Scripture say something about how God already knows what I need before I even ask him? Rohr, in his book that we've been quoting a lot, says, "We pray to form a living relationship, not to get things done. Only in a relationship with God can I grow in my understanding of how he loves me and how he sees me. God is the one who can help me find true humility, that idea of being my true self. God is the one that helps me find it because he's the one that actually sees me for who I really am." Asking God to remove my shortcomings is about putting down this heavy baggage, these shortcomings that I've been carrying around with me, a putting down that can bring freedom to our weary souls. And we all have those places inside where we feel weary because we've been carrying things. But when your hands are no longer full of suitcase handles, carrying these things around with you, they can be open to embrace the living God, the way he's embracing you. Benner again says, "To be touched by God's love is to be forever changed. To surrender to divine love is to find our soul's home, the place and identity for which we yearn in every cell of our being. The idea of finding my soul's true home, if I can be my true self that is deeply loved by God, it opens me up to see him everywhere." My brother-in-law, Brandon, who's a pastor in Milwaukee, has a blog that I read. And I'm going to read to you part of what he wrote about this idea of seeing God everywhere. And he sees it in the people around him. So he's in a coffee shop in this blog, and he's editing a picture that he took at a wedding. And he kind of gets overwhelmed by how beautiful it is. And he says, "The beauty of this picture was a revelation in another way as well. When I looked up from my computer screen, the simple world around me was gleaming with new beauty. It was like my filter had been dislodged, and I could actually see the beauty that had always been there all around me. The transcendent beauty in every human was now visible. And I fought off tears. I fought with the urge to grab strangers and tell them how beautiful they were. I fought with the captivating need to look, to stare at people who had now become as significant to me as I was anonymous to them. All these beautiful people laughing and crying together, each impossibly unique and gloriously complex and mysterious and wonderful. Overloaded with the emotional weight of exposure to so much unfiltered beauty, I could see all of these souls in a beautiful mind sort of way. The collective beauty of the coffee shop's congregation overwhelmed me and washed over me in waves of sunshine and hope. I wish I could have bottled it. The microscopic details that made my new loved one so beautiful, pores and skin and hair and teeth and laughter unique to each human like a fingerprint and a choir of unique voices of height and fashion and their eyes and what they were doing, glorious, all of it. And all of it hitting me at once in my little chair at the far end of the coffee shop. It struck me that this was the truth about these people. They had always been this beautiful, this precious, this glorious. We look at them every day, but we don't see them. There is so much beauty in others and in ourselves but we don't trust it or believe it. I wonder if we really saw each other in ourselves, in our unfiltered glory, would things change? Maybe we don't need to focus on the ugliness, the shortcomings that is so easily visible in our world, but on the truth that the ugliness conceals. Glorious, immutable beauty everywhere and in everyone. I want my life to be about this beauty and this truth. I want to live and speak and love and work in a way that points people to this truth and reveals the dazzling sunshine hidden beneath our skin. The world is full of breathtakingly beautiful people. You are one of them. Now, I said earlier that humility is being your true self. And hear me, please. Your true self is beautiful. It's not defined by your past mistakes or your shortcomings or your failure to reach some future potential. Your true self is sitting here in this moment. You are the beloved of God, and He longs to help you move forward. He longs to heal your true self, your soul, and your true self is light. It is hope for the work of the kingdom to be done here and now. And it is precious not only in my sight or in my brother-in-law Brandon's sight, but it is precious in God's sight as well.
So after today, we will be two-thirds of the way through this series called Everyone Anonymous. So if you have joined us in the middle, I apologize because what I'm about to say might not make full sense. So I encourage you to go back and read or listen to them and go through the steps in order because that's how they're meant to be. But I wanted to, before we jump into step eight, which is what I'm going to talk about today, I thought I'd get some feedback on how the series is going. So tell me your thoughts. How's it been going for you? Has it been different than you expected? And so on. What's been helpful? Any and all thoughts, just general feedback. Yes, we are going really fast through the steps. It's really a challenge to talk about all the steps and in this really fast order because I haven't had a whole lot of experience with AA, so I'm really glad to have some good resources of people who are much wiser and more experienced with the process. Other thoughts? Yeah, I think that's good to not feel pressure that you have to go through the process really fast, but take note of each step and do what you can. Yeah. And I've also heard that sometimes people go through passes. So it's like you go through at a certain level of depth and then you start again. I even read specifically with this step that that it's kind of like a lifelong process of always keeping track of how have you harmed people and going back and making amends with them. So I think it is something that you do your best and then you try again and you keep learning and growing and refine it. Yeah, I think that's good. It's not like a completion. It's a lot. Yeah, we are making changes, but it's a constant journey. Good thought. Well, thank you for that feedback. So step eight says this. We made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. So making a list of all people we have harmed and being willing to make amends to them all. This step is actually not even taking the step of making the amends, but preparing to make amends. So I want to point out some important elements in this step, and then I actually want to leave time at the end for us to think about who would be on that list. Who are some people that maybe we've harmed? We've been encouraging everybody to identify one specific struggle or some unmanageable sin or some issue that you're dealing with that you'd like to change. And how is that specific thing? How have you harmed people in your life because of that issue? So it obviously recognizing that our sin, that our issues affect those around us is an important part of this step. Really coming to grips with not just that a general idea that, yeah, I've hurt people or, yeah, I've made mistakes or, yeah, I've been selfish, but how exactly have we harmed? To do a thorough investigation, thinking back last year, what were my relationships like? The people that knew me, the people that were close to me? How did I affect them? And going, I've heard in the book that even year by year, make a thorough investigation and an assessment of the people in your life. And even if you've lost contact with the people and you wouldn't make amends with them, still put them on the list to think through what is that. One important element is before we actually ask other people to forgive us, it's important to forgive them. Because I think it's going to be a natural reaction once you start making this list of people who have harmed you. It's a lot easier to think about of people you have harmed. It's a lot easier to think of people who've harmed you. And you'll think, well, the reason I harmed them is because they're a jerk. Or because they do this all the time to me, and so that's why it stirs this quality that I don't like out of me. And so you might have a knee-jerk reaction thinking, oh, well, I don't really want to put this person on the list because I don't like them. So part of the process that this step really brings out is forgiving other people, because really, really approaching them with compassion and understanding that just as I have my issues, my sin, that person that hurt you is broken. And maybe they're hurting you because of their unmanageable issue. And so understanding that we're all in the same boat. So be careful with this step to not think about, oh, well, that person's harmed me. This step is more about us and dealing with our stuff and being willing to forgive someone even if they haven't asked for forgiveness. There's a quote that Richard Rohr said this: instead of making lists of those who hurt me, I now make lists of people I have perhaps hurt or failed or mistreated, and then do something about it. It might be a note, a call, a visit, a meaningful gift, an invitation, or an outright apology. Making such a list will change your foundational consciousness from one of feeding resentments to a mind that is both grateful and humble. I think part of the beauty of this step is that it helps us not only to restore some of those broken relationships, those people that we've hurt, but also helps to transform our outlook on life and be less self-focused. So forgiving others and also forgiving ourselves. Before we ask other people to forgive us, we really need to forgive ourselves and be free of that shame and that guilt that Vicky talked about. I actually read one thing this week that actually writing out an apology to yourself and say, hey, Dustin, you've done this and I am so sorry. I've done this, and I'm so sorry. And here, like, writing out to yourself and then reading it out loud in a mirror. And that people have found that to be a really therapeutic approach to being able to forgive yourself, because you're asking other people to forgive you. And if you're not willing to receive their forgiveness, it kind of stifles the process. In the Life Recovery Bible, it said this: when we prepare to make amends, we also need to prepare our heart to accept whatever love, support, or friendship is offered in return. So I think that was a really insightful for me, because here we are making this list of people and preparing to make amends with them, but the hope is that those people would accept us. And you make amends and you don't, I think we should tailor our expectations that maybe people are going to be critical, or, you know, they're going to doubt that we're actually changing, or maybe they're still bitter that we have hurt them. But some people will say, hey, I accept you and I accept your apology and thank you so much. And there'll be some restoration that happens in that. So the hope would be that they would offer some support in return. So, and then thirdly, preparing to make amends. The very most practical step is actually listing out the people that you will be making amends with. But also begin to think through each person individually and not only what you're going to say, because some people, you might not be able to go in as deep of a story. It might not matter to them. Like maybe you only know them loosely. And so you customizing what you're saying and how you're apologizing to people. And so not only the content, but also how you approach that apology. I was reminded of a book that my mom gave me this week called Five Languages of Apology. And she wrote this in the front cover. She's actually standing right here, or sitting right there, so maybe hopefully I'm not embarrassing her. But she said, "To Dustin, for the many times we've apologized over the years, I hope to get even better at it. I love you, Mom." So I've got a great family support system. One thing that stuck out, one of my bigger apologies was I was a freshman in high school, and I was about to fail two classes, and it was the worst report card that I have ever gotten. And my parents have always had really high expectations. And so they try to encourage us to get good grades. And I did. That was not a good year for me. Biology. Actually, my dad and Ryan both took biology from Mr. Coat. Same guy. So they know. Maybe there's some justification for me almost failing. I think it was, you know, that in high school, it's quarters. It was C plus, C minus, D plus, D minus. That was my quarters. Anyway, so I wrote out this, like, I felt terrible, and I knew that they would be disappointed, and I wrote out this letter, and, like, I don't know how many years later my mom showed me. She kept the letter. I'm like, "So I'm so sorry. I'm going to try my best," and blah, blah, blah. And so anyway, that was one of our apologies. So the reason I bring up this book is because it highlights several aspects of apology, and I think this is really helpful to think through when we're preparing to make amends with people. And so I love these. There's expressing regret. There's accepting responsibility. There's making restitution. Fourth, genuinely repenting. And finally, requesting forgiveness. So I thought to illustrate some of the nuances and the differences in these aspects, I'd give a simple illustration. So this is a fictitious story, but it'll kind of help you see how you can fully apologize or apologize in different ways, because people hear apologies in different ways. I know for me, making restitution is a big one. So anytime I'm apologizing to someone, I'm like, "How can I make it up to you?" But for Christina, she likes to hear me say, "I was wrong." That seriously, I can say, "Hey, how can I fix it?" You know, whatever. And she doesn't feel like it's a full apology until I say, "I was wrong." So pay attention to how your apology language and the person that you're going to be apologizing to. Think through how might they hear apologies or what might be most important to them. So let's pretend that Christina had a late night meeting and I was at home by myself and snacking and just enjoying, you know, the night free. And then she comes home and she wants to relax and have some ice cream and sit in front of the TV. And she opens the freezer and realizes, "I ate all of the mint chocolate chip ice cream." This is a pretend story. But, so I ate all of the mint chocolate chip ice cream, and she's angry, and she confronts me, and she looks in the trash, and there is the empty carton. And she says, "You seriously did that?" So this is how I could do all these facets. "Christina, expressing regret, I am so sorry that I ate all of the mint chocolate chip ice cream. I should not have done that." 2, accepting responsibility. "I was wrong to eat all of your mint chocolate chip ice cream. I know that mint chocolate chip ice cream is your favorite, and it was my fault. I was wrong to do that." 3, making restitution. "What can I do to make this right? I will go to the store and buy another carton right now. Or the next time, you can take my allowance and buy 2 cartons." It doesn't have to even come from the grocery budget. I will make this right. I will fix this. 4, genuinely repenting. "I will try to never do that again. I will never eat the last of the mint chocolate chip ice cream. From now on, I will do my best to respect your serving size of mint chocolate chip ice cream. See, are you catching the nuances of the differences? And then finally, requesting forgiveness. I don't want this to come between us. Will you please forgive me? Will you please accept my apology? So, there's some of those facets. I really love this list. It was really enlightening to think through. So, different aspects of apology. So, I think this is a really great step to, because it's later in the process, people are more willing to have seen your changes along the way, hopefully, and see that, yes, I believe your apology is genuine, and we can start new. Because this step is about not only restoring what was broken, but also learning how to not repeat the same mistakes. And so now we're on step 8, and so we're hopefully to the point. I mean, if some people spend a year on even one of these steps, you know, there's a lot of change and a lot of transformation that's happening along the way. And so by the time you actually make amends with people, hopefully these relationships can start to be restored. And you can start to have healthy relationships where you're not harming people, you're not hurting people. My last quote is this one from the 12 Steps book. It says, "This is a very large order. Learning to live in the greatest peace, partnership, and brotherhood with all men and women is a moving and fascinating adventure. Every AA has found that he can make little headway in this new adventure of living until he first backtracks and really makes an accurate and unsparing survey of the human wreckage he has left in his wake." So it's one thing to acknowledge that you've messed up. It's another thing to try and change that. It's an even further step to write out a list of all the things that all the ways you've harmed people, and to make amends with those, to build those relationships back. And so, because this step is so critical, and because we're moving so fast through them, I actually thought I should give everybody a few minutes to think through this step. Who would you put on this list? And actually take a few minutes to start. I don't expect anyone to finish this process, but I thought, might as well start because we are moving so quickly. Here's a chance to start. So let's take a few moments to actually start the step, and here's some questions to think through. Who have you directly harmed? Who have you indirectly harmed? Who have you taken advantage of? Or what relationships have you neglected? Because of your issue and the thing that you deal with, who have you harmed emotionally that's around you? Or maybe the issue that you deal with has caused you to be controlling or depressed or critical or callous or irresponsible. Or maybe you've been absent and you haven't been as present. Your issue has held you back from being the person that the people around you needed to be. So the step is not necessarily to focus on the failures, but it's to acknowledge them. It's to focus on those relationships. But as you're doing it, it is helpful to notice the patterns and seeing how do you harm people? What are some of the similarities? And it's further evidence and clues as to what needs changed. So take a few minutes. There should be note cards in the pews in front of you. So if you need a sheet of paper to write on, and I think Ashby helped to put some pencils out as well. I have one pen if someone wants it. Any takers? No? Okay. Yes? I'm going to toss it. So I'll give you a few minutes, and then I'll close with a prayer. So combined with the next step, which we'll get to next week, this is really a fresh start for a lot of relationships. And so this prayer is called, "Help Me to Believe in Beginnings." God of history and of my heart, so much has happened to me during these whirlwind days. I've known death and birth. I've been brave and scared. I've hurt. I've helped. I've been honest. I've lied. I've destroyed. I've created. I've been with people. I've been lonely. I've been loyal, and I've betrayed. I've decided. I've waffled. I've laughed, and I've cried. You know my frail heart and my frayed history, and now another day begins. Oh God, help me to believe in beginnings, and in my beginning again, no matter how often I have failed before. Help me to make beginnings, to begin going out of my weary mind into fresh dreams, daring to make my own bold tracks in the land of now, to begin forgiving, that I may experience mercy, to begin questioning the unquestionable, that I may know truth, to begin disciplining, that I may create beauty, to begin sacrificing, that I may accomplish justice, to begin risking, that I may make peace, to begin loving, that I may realize joy. Help me to be a beginning for others, to be a singer to the songless, a storyteller to the aimless, a befriender of the friendless, to become a beginning of hope for the despairing, of assurance for the doubting, of reconciliation for the divided, to become a beginning of freedom for the oppressed, of comfort for the sorrowing, of friendship for the forgotten, to become a beginning of beauty for the forlorn, of sweetness for the soured, of gentleness for the angry, of wholeness for the broken, and of peace for the frightened and violent of the earth. Help me to believe in beginnings, to make a beginning, to be a beginning, so that I might not just grow old, but grow new. Each day of this wild, amazing life, you call me to live with the passion of Jesus Christ. Amen.